Wednesday, November 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Iraqi forces advance on the Islamic State held city of Mosul.
They say that the fighting is really difficult, but they are pushing into Mosul.
Utah voters express unhappiness with the two major party presidential candidates, and we get the latest Prince news 6 months after the performer's death. It's all ahead. On Wednesday, Iraqi forces were delayed by poor weather as they advanced on the Islamic State-held city of Mosul. Meanwhile, the aid agency, the Norwegian Refugee Council, warned civilians in the city are in great danger as the battle intensifies. Iraqi special forces seized control of state television facilities inside Mosul on Tuesday. Kurdish and Western journalists embedded with the force said it was meeting stiff resistance inside the city, encountering concrete blast walls and roadside bombs planted by IS fighters to slow the Iraqi advance. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil. She has visited the area close to the fighting and tells me about what she's learned.
Well, in talking to soldiers today coming back from the battles, they say that the fighting is really difficult, but they are pushing into Mosul. The estimate a couple of soldiers gave me coming out today was about 800 meters to the city limits, although there have been conflicting reports about whether they're in the city limits or just close to them. They say the fighting is really difficult. They can't use airstrikes for the most part because civilians are everywhere, so they are fighting on the streets. And Islamic State militants' two greatest weapons are suicide vests and car bomb explosions, which can also be suicide operations. So these two things are really difficult to fight.
Yeah, I know that some aid organizations are extremely concerned about the situation involving the civilians. But I would assume at this point it's too difficult to kind of exactly know what's going on there because of the fighting.
That's true. I mean, there have been numerous reports that Islamic State militants are expected to and have in the past and are continuing to use civilians as human shields. These are people that would otherwise, you would assume, escape the fighting and run to refugee camps that are being set up all over the region. That being said, the International Organization for Migration says as of today, more than 20,000 people have fled Islamic State territories as this operation has gone on, which is 2 weeks and a day now. So if depending on how things go, they expect it's possible that a million more people could be displaced. And this could mean a huge humanitarian crisis because although all the aid organizations are scrambling to get ready for all of these internally displaced people, they don't have enough resources at this time.
Now, I believe you also got yourself, you got fairly close to some of the fighting. You saw a flag of the Islamic State?
Yes. The other day, we went up to the front lines of Beshika, a village that is one of the last villages that Peshmerga soldiers are planning to recapture. And we were quite close. We were about 300 meters from the village, and you could, in the distance, see their black flag. Unfortunately, we didn't have a camera good enough to get a picture, but the fighting at the time we were there was light. It was just an exchange of gunfire back and forth, but they did say that it did warn us not to stay too long because mortars were regularly thrown into that area.
Is it known as the fighting as it approaches, gets into Mosul, where Islamic State fighters might flee to?
Well, it's believed that the only real place they could flee to at this point would have to be Syria. So what people say is, well, some of them will flee to Raqqa, which is the largest Islamic State stronghold in Syria. And some people say that many Islamic State militants or their leaders have already gone to Raqqa, either from the areas that have already been recaptured or from Mosul itself. Now, what they're doing is not known. It's not something that's been made public. However, there's also the question of, will they flee? Of course, some will flee and some will get to Syria, but it'll be difficult because presumably the entire country will be controlled by Iraqi and Peshmerga forces. So how are they going to get there? In the past, they have, as I said before, frequently used suicide vests as a weapon. So it makes it very difficult for forces here to take prisoners and get information, because a lot of the time, as according to soldiers I've spoken to, they either flee, and if they can't flee, they kill themselves.
Heather, what kind of destruction have you seen, as the fighting intensifies?
Everywhere you go where Islamic State soldiers controlled the area that has been recaptured by Iraqi or Peshmerga forces, you see destruction. I mean, it's overwhelming. Electricity cords are cut, houses are bombed and burned, destroyed, gun shells. This area was, prior to Islamic State occupation, a normal bustling area outside Iraq's second largest city. And now it's a wasteland. Most of the people, anyone who could, had fled years ago. One city we went to today, Bartella, was a Christian city, and it's now basically flattened, and it has no electricity and no water. People are coming back and saying, we want to move in. And the army is saying, actually, we have at least cleared this area of IEDs and booby traps in houses. But there's really nothing for them to be able to move into at this point. In other places, Islamic State has, as they fled, set oil fields on fire and a sulfur plant on fire. So basically, the recovery from the Islamic State is going to be probably a lot, lot longer than the actual occupation if the forces are successful in taking back Mosul.
That's VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in Erbil, Iraq. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, I know you've got a lot of reaction to the latest election news.
Absolutely. For the next 6 days until the election, we're going to continue to have a lot of social media reaction. And it's almost hard to keep up with, because as these new polls come out, people jump on the new data trying to parse through it and figure out what it means. But something I wanted to highlight just relating to social media regarding this FBI release of information. Of course, they've released information saying that they were going to look into some devices from Hillary Clinton's staff. They released some information about an old investigation from Bill Clinton. And the way that they released this is through a Twitter account, at FBI Records Vault. Now, the weird thing with this is that that account was dormant for a year until it started tweeting out these different documents. In fact, the first document it tweeted out just last past week was about Donald Trump's father. So both sides are kind of pointing at this and saying, how bizarre that this Twitter account was dormant. No one was using it. And now all of a sudden it's just kicked up again. The FBI says it was an error. They didn't realize it had been dormant, but not a lot of people are buying that, saying, how do you not realize that something has been down for a year? So we'll have to see if they have any more explanation on that on the social media front. But
yeah, interesting.
Something relating to the election today, perhaps curious timing in and of itself. Today is National Stress Awareness Day. So we're seeing that hashtag trending and a lot of people saying, breathe, relax, meditate, take a walk. Good tips as we approach this election. And on the note of the election and stress reduction, the Weather Channel has made an interesting announcement here in the U.S. They said that while everybody else is going to be covering the election on November 8th, the Weather Channel will be airing a quote-unquote chill marathon. They're not going to talk about the election at all. They're going to show beautiful scenes of natural kind of bucolic fields and mountains and fall foliage, and they're going to play smooth jazz music as kind of counter-programming to the election. So if you're looking to get away from all the election news and you're in the U.S., you can turn to the Weather Channel and you can take a bit of a reprieve on Election Day.
You can kind of decompress there.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The suspect is in custody after ambush-style killings of two police officers in Iowa. The Pentagon says a senior al-Qaeda member is killed in Syria. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton assail each other as unfit for the U.S. presidency. And the United Nations says France and Britain failed obligations regarding children at the refugee camp in Calais. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests what caused the formation of the moon may have also knocked Earth nearly on its side and caused it to spin faster on its axis. The most popular theory on the moon's formation is that it was made from debris left over from a violent collision between Earth and a Mars-sized protoplanet some 4.5 billion years ago. Interactions between the Earth and Moon over the billions of years that followed are thought to have slowed Earth's rotational speed and brought the tilt of its spin axis to its current 23.5 degrees. The model also suggests the Moon's tilt initially mirrored Earth's and orbited 15 times closer than today. It's thought that tidal actions between the two and the Sun's gravitational influence pushed the Moon to its current location and reduced its orbital tilt to its current 5 degrees. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the late singer Prince continues to create controversy 6 months after his death. As the U.S. presidential race enters its final days, one state is watching the campaign with a unique perspective. The western state of Utah has a majority of voters who are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormons. Voters there are not happy with the candidacies of either Republican Donald Trump or Democrat Hillary Clinton. I spoke with VOA's Ramon Taylor, who traveled to Utah last week to report on the campaign there. He tells me how Utah voters are viewing the contest.
Well, it's a really interesting case study. In this case, we're talking about a state that is very socially conservative. In past elections, they have gone for a Republican candidate, you know, almost handily. The last time that there was an exception was 1964, and that was a landslide victory for Lyndon Johnson. So, I mean, we're talking about a very, very long span, a state where Mitt Romney beat Barack Obama by a huge margin, 73% to 27%. And Trump isn't doing so well, especially when consider the fact that this is a three-way race. Mormons in the state, and that they comprise about 60% of the entire population, have a real problem with some of the rhetoric that has come out of Trump's mouth from some recent rallies and from the leaked tape where he suggested that sexual assault towards women was, you know, a bragging right. And so this idea of family, honest integrity, these are values that Mormons hold dear, and it's a reason why Trump is really faring not so great in this poll.
Do you know, has Trump done any campaigning there?
Trump hasn't made a recent trip out there, but his running mate Pence was there last week. And in fact, that's sort of a cause for concern for the campaign. At this stage of the race, 1 week before we head to the polls, it's really almost unheard of that there would be any sort of campaigning in Utah. And that's because it's normally just a victory that's handed to the Republican candidate. This is not the case. And the fact that his running mate, Mike Pence, campaigned in front of a huge rally in Salt Lake City means that they're sort of on their heels right now, and they have to make a last final push to get out the vote in what is a really tight three-way race.
How do voters feel about Hillary Clinton and your discussions with them? What did they say about her?
You know, Hillary Clinton is unpopular in the state, just as she is among Republicans generally nationwide. But in this case, it's a weird scenario where Mormon voters in particular don't know what to do. They don't want to cast a vote for Hillary Clinton because that goes against everything that they know in terms of their socially conservative policies. But they also don't want to cast a vote for Trump. And so the fact that a third-party candidate who's from Utah, former CIA official who has spent a lot of time in the state, is running really gives them a chance to, even if he doesn't have a chance to win, just let them vote their consciences and be happy about the vote, you know, when they tell their children about it years down the road.
Yeah, that candidate, Evan McMullen, he's from Utah, and he is a Mormon. Were you able to talk to some voters out there about his candidacy?
Yeah, in fact, we did speak with a number of families. We spoke to the Thorsons just outside of Salt Lake City, who told us that they're really disillusioned with this campaign. They realize that a vote for McMullen probably, you know, might not result in his presidency. A lot of voters realize that, but they like the ideals that he stands for, just like Mitt Romney did. You know, he's a true conservative in their eyes, you know, pro-life in that sense, which is something that's very important to these voters. But they have they're really ticked off by some of the things that Trump has said about regarding treatment towards women, regarding immigration, the idea of a Muslim ban. Remember, these are Mormons, not Muslims, but as a religious minority themselves who have a history of persecution, this all really relates to them. And so Evan McMullen has really pushed for what he calls a new conservative movement, even after this campaign ends And he's really, really digging into Donald Trump right now as a candidate who is trying to garner the support of white supremacists, something that he is not for himself.
VOA's Ramon Taylor. This is VOA.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people choose a new president. VOA's live election night coverage begins at 2200 hours Universal Time. As events unfold, we'll bring you the finale of this historic campaign from Washington and VOA correspondents across the United States and around the world. Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, you'll hear comprehensive coverage until the last speech is done. It's America Votes 2016 on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Millions of music fans had their first listen to Prince 34 years ago this week with the release of his 1999 album. Today, 6 months have already passed since his death, and there remains a lot of news about Prince. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and International Edition host Jim Stevenson delve into the latest.
First of all, the investigation into Prince's death will remain sealed until next year, so we're really not going to learn any more specifics. He passed away from an overdose of the drug fentanyl, and police continue to investigate the circumstances surrounding that death. On October 21st, a Minnesota judge extended authorities' search warrant until commencement of criminal proceedings. So that something is still in the works there.
The investigation into his death is quite different from what we saw in Michael Jackson's case, where we knew who the doctor was right away, and there were all sorts of allegations and media reports swirling about him almost immediately.
Well, there were some initial allegations aimed at Prince's physicians, but those seem to have gone away or are simply not being reported on right now. It's very much still under investigation, and they're keeping a tight lid on things. The judge also sealed all documents accompanying that investigation. Now, the website The Wrap says that those documents will remain sealed until next April, which would be the one-year anniversary of Prince's passing.
No!
In other developments, his attorney, L. Londell McMillan, is denying reports that Jay-Z offered $40 million to buy the rights to Prince's unreleased music. He says those music rights are not up for sale, and those responsible are not in discussions with anyone. I don't know if I believe that.
Quite in a massive state sitting there in Minnesota, in both terms of money and also the wealth of music. Apparently, he was just recording constantly.
He was recording constantly. And also, as far as his estate, his physical estate goes, his compound, Paisley Park, there was talk of turning it into a museum. Now, it's in a semi-rural area. It's not very well served by roads. And the county commissioners are a little reluctant to go ahead with that because they worry about Graceland-style crowds. He has so much unreleased music there. And Billboard recently reported that the three U.S. major labels, Sony, Universal, and Warner, are definitely in talks for the rights. They would love to get their hands on this music. And finally, there's the matter of Prince's estate. People claiming to be relatives of Prince continue to emerge from the woodwork. This Wednesday, a judge ruled that two women claiming to be his niece and grandniece are not heirs, so they will not get anything. Prince died without a will, and this complicates things to an incredible degree. A lot of things going on with Prince still.
A lot of news about the Purple One and a man who sometimes wears purple while he does his top 20 countdown, Ray McDonald. You can also catch him on Twitter
at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Music of Prince. Well, in Moscow, Amnesty International says the staff of its branch there arrived at work Wednesday morning to find their office sealed with a notice from municipal authorities warning people not to enter. The international rights group said the locks on the doors of its office in the Russian capital had been changed and that no explanation had been given. Amnesty International Europe Director John Dalhousen said in a statement that the organization did not know what prompted Moscow authorities to prevent the staff from accessing the offices and called it an unwelcome surprise for which it received no prior warning. Dalhousen said he hoped there was a simple administrative explanation for this setback to our work and that the group had fulfilled all its obligations as tenants. Amnesty International rents its Moscow office from city authorities, whom the group says it has been unable to reach to resolve the situation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said he knew nothing about the closure of Amnesty International's Moscow office. On Tuesday, the organization called on Russian authorities to investigate allegations made by Ildar Dadin, a jailed anti-Kremlin protester, that he'd been beaten and tortured in prison. Well, that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The humanitarian and human rights situation in Aleppo is dire. Secretary of State John Kerry described the situation in Syria as one of the largest humanitarian disasters since World War II. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has described Aleppo as a slaughterhouse. The brutal facts, said U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations in Geneva, Theodore Allegra, must shock us still further. Over 275,000 people remain trapped in eastern Aleppo. Russia and the Syrian regime's recent assault have killed 400 people, including 100 children, in markets, in bakeries, in schools, at water stations, in mosques, and even in hospitals. Thousands are wounded and cannot access medical care. People are starving and drink contaminated water. The handful of brave doctors and first responders who remain in Aleppo work tirelessly to save lives, even as they face continued assaults. The few remaining hospitals are overwhelmed. People with serious wounds are left on the street in body bags to make room for others who can be treated more quickly. Airstrikes by Russia and the Assad regime are the cause of this devastation, and they are the cause of this suffering, said Deputy Representative Allegra. And let me emphasize, no pause can be a substitute for a genuine end to the violence and full access for humanitarian aid. So Russia and the regime owe the world much more than excuses. Why do they keep hitting hospitals and medical facilities? And why do they keep targeting children and women? These shocking acts in Aleppo, he said, beg for an appropriate investigation, and those who commit them must be held accountable. The United States reiterates its call for an immediate end to all violations and all abuses. Furthermore, the U.S. calls for accountability for those who perpetrate them, especially the egregious, the widespread, and the persistent human rights and humanitarian violations committed by the Assad regime against the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.